This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Many of us have a conflicted relationship with sleep. For some, there's no greater pleasure than popping on a set of flannel pajamas and drifting off. But for others, going to bed is more of a battle, and waking up is even worse. So why do people approach sleep so differently, and how can we all get the rest that we need? Today, we dive under the covers to learn about the science and history of sleep. We'll hear from experts in psychology, neurology, history, and even lemur biology. And they'll all help us understand shut-eye better and how we can learn to get those 7 or 8 hours. The show is part of our new series, Embodied, conversations about sex, relationships, and your health. Joining me first is Jade Wu. She is a health psychologist at Duke University who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. She's also the host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. Jade, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can join our conversation today on Twitter using the hashtag embodied. So we said that you were a sleep psychologist. What does a sleep psychologist do?
Well, most of the time I help people with insomnia and other sleep problems that can be improved with non-medication approaches.
And how did you get into this work?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, so the foundation of my training is in clinical psychology in general. And I started out in mood and anxiety research. And the more I did that, the more I realized, oh my goodness, sleep is such an important part of all of this. And it's such a low-hanging fruit in a way. Like if we could just improve people's sleep, they would have better mood, they would function better. And then I ended up doing my thesis in Parkinson's disease. And I realized there too, sleep is really important. There's really no place in healthcare that you can look where sleep isn't an important factor. So I decided to get into sleep science.
And you have a deep family history with sleep science. I learned that you were trying to avoid studying it for a long time.
I was because, you know, I think all kids try to not follow in their parents' footsteps. But I think I was like 5 years old when I first stepped foot into a sleep lab because my father actually did sleep research in the Chinese equivalent of NASA. So he was working with astronauts and doing research on how space travel would affect circadian rhythms in sleep. So I guess the seed was sown very early on.
You couldn't walk away from it.
No, I couldn't.
So tell us, what is sleep? What is happening to the body?
Yeah, that is a surprisingly difficult question to answer. I was actually just at a sleep scientific conference where we spent 2 hours defining sleep and talking about what normal sleep is. So I'll try to way condense that.
Okay.
But essentially, we can all agree that sleep is a naturally occurring biological process where we become reversibly unconscious, as in we can be woken up. And during this state, our bodies and our brains are doing things that are different than when we're awake. I know that sounds like a really vague definition, but that's because honestly, we don't have all the mystery solved yet.
And we've learned a lot about sleep cycles, especially with the rise in, you know, tracking apps.
You can maybe
watch or maybe inaccurately watch your sleep cycles throughout the night. So what are the different stages of sleep in these sleep cycles we're going through?
So there are two main types of sleep. One is called REM sleep. That stands for rapid eye movement. And the other type is creatively called non-REM. So these are the two main categories. And so non-REM sleep is further broken up into stage 1, 2, and 3, basically light, medium, and deep. And deep sleep is also known as slow wave sleep, delta sleep, deep sleep. And during non-REM sleep, there's a lot of body repair, growth, restoration of the body, rest. So for example, human growth hormone peaks in how much is being released in the body during deep sleep. So that's why kids need a lot of sleep, need a lot of deep sleep because they're growing. Sex hormones are also being released during this stage. That's why teenagers also need a lot of sleep because they're going through puberty. And we're also consolidating memories. So the things that we're learning throughout the day, whether it's from a textbook or whether it's from the free throw line, we're actually continuing to learn and improve during sleep. And what else? Memory consolidation. And the brain is also doing some janitorial work, very important janitorial work. We're clearing out debris from the cerebral spinal fluid, that just basically junk in the brain that we don't need. And with this clearing out, we're sort of resetting and we're maintaining brain health. So if we're not getting enough deep sleep, then we don't have enough opportunity to do this important clearing out work. And the debris can build up over time into unhelpful protein plaques and tangles that are implicated in Alzheimer's disease.
Right. So not getting deep sleep and not going through all these various stages not only impacts our mental health and our feelings of restfulness, but actually mm-hmm. like the physiological processes that are happening in Absolutely. Our body.
Absolutely. That's why it's extremely important for young people, especially, to get the sleep that they need so they can properly develop their bodies and their brains at these very critical periods.
You've also said that looking at shift workers and kind of this struggle in the changes in circadian rhythm can tell us a lot about how important sleep is. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So shift workers are actually at higher risk for health problems and mental health problems. And in fact, shift work is the only non-chemical carcinogen, probable carcinogen, on the carcinogen list. So that tells you how big of a problem it is. And it's not just about sleep. It's not just that shift workers are not getting as much sleep. It's that their biological clocks are thrown off. And that's a real problem. And we're finding out more and more that, you know, we shouldn't just be talking about sleep. That's like talking about yin without talking about yang. Doesn't really make sense. It's really about the 24-hour cycle and the consistency of that cycle and the health of that cycle.
So tell me about that 24-hour cycle and the circadian rhythm. And you have a great metaphor, I think, about a train station that helps us understand.
Yeah, this is what I share with patients. So I like to think about the circadian system, which is not just one brain area or one thing that's happening in your body. It's a network of lots and lots, in fact, billions of different clocks in your body, with one central clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. So we can call that SCN for short. And the whole system is like a busy train station with that one big clock tower in the middle, and every passenger and train conductor and ticket salesperson has their own watch to look at, right? So imagine if that big clock tower just randomly changed its time and or ran at a different speed, or you could never really predict what that was going to say, and everyone's desperately trying to tune their own watches to that main clock, how chaotic of a train station would that be, right? So ideally, all the trains are running on time, all the passengers and everybody has the same time on their watches that runs at the same speed. So the whole biological system is similar. We want all of our cycles to be running in sync with each other for optimal health.
I'm talking with Jade Wu. She's a health psychologist at Duke, specializing in behavioral sleep medicine. This is Embodied Today on the State of Things. So we've heard this night owls and early birds or morning larks. So mm-hmm. do we all have the same circadian rhythm, or is there actual naturally occurring differences?
There are definitely naturally occurring differences. So we are all biologically wired to be either a morning lark, a night owl, or somewhere in the middle. And this is largely driven by genetics. So we can't help it. And there's actually differences in the length of our cycles depending on what we have. So, for example, I'm a night owl. So I probably don't have a 24-hour cycle. I probably have something more like a 24.3-hour cycle, meaning if I had no social obligations, no work, and I lived in a cave, I would just want to go to bed early, later and later each day and wake up later and later each day, whereas people who are morning people tend to have closer to a 24-hour cycle, though the average, I believe, is about 24.1 hours.
Why are there these differences? Is there any advantage or was there in the past?
Well, it's hard to say, but my pet theory is that back in the day, you know, some people in the tribe had to be restless at night while everybody else was sleeping to keep an eye out for nocturnal predators, right? So I like to say, you're welcome. We're like the we're like the night watchmen who walked around and kept everybody safe.
So is it possible to reset your circadian rhythm? Because, I mean, I'm imagining, you know, for us here in the State of Things, our workday starts at 9 a.m. So mm-hmm. whether or not you're a night owl or early bird, we need you to be here. Is it possible for people to reset those?
Yes, absolutely. Because if we do have to be adaptable to our environment, right? So the SCN, that master clock in the brain, responds really well to light. So if we get a dose of sunlight first thing in the morning consistently, and we minimize the amount of light at night, a night owl can actually shift a little bit earlier. And actually, one of my very favorite studies conducted in Colorado, they basically took night owls camping for a week, and they were not allowed to have any electronics, you know, after dark. So all they had was the campfire, and they got up basically with the light. And after a week, not only did they feel like they could sort of keep up with the morning people, their melatonin profiles actually matched morning people's too. So it shows that there's actually a profound biological change where their circadian rhythms were able to be shifted. So it's possible.
Okay, that's good news for a lot of people out there. I'm talking with Jade Wu. She is a health psychologist at Duke University who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. She's also the host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. She'll stay with us as we continue our conversation just ahead about sleep, and we'll explore how our ancestors used to sleep and how it was different than how we sleep today. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. It's Embodied Today, our series about sex, relationships, and health. And we're talking about sleep. We generally do it once a day in one long block, but it turns out that humans have not always slept that way. Roger E. Kirch is a university distinguished professor in the Department of History at Virginia Tech. More than a decade ago, he uncovered a pattern of sleep that was common in humans before the Industrial Revolution. They would sleep in segments, snoozing for 3 or 4 hours, waking up for a few hours, and then going back to sleep. So why is segmented sleep no longer the norm? Roger E. Kirch joins me now to explain it all. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anita. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So you are a historian. What inspires a historian to become interested in sleep?
Well, I was writing a book beginning in the mid-1980s that took 20 years. It was about nighttime before the Industrial Revolution and Western culture came out under the title At Day's Close, Night and Time's Past. I must tell you that I undertook the topic of sleep with profound reluctance.
Why is that?
Well, I knew that sleep was a universal necessity. I also wrongly assumed that it was a biological constant, and hence I was quite concerned how I would find enough interesting information between the late Middle Ages and the Industrial Revolution to justify a single chapter. As things turned out, I filled 3 chapters, and I made several what to me were fascinating discoveries.
Well, yeah, I mean, when your research became public, I would say it's safe to say that you kind of broke the internet. You described this pattern of sleep that we didn't know about that was really shocking to a lot of people. So tell me about segmented sleep and how you discovered it.
Well, segmented sleep, or bimodal or biphasic sleep, as it's sometimes termed, was, in my view, as an historian, the dominant pattern of sleep in the Western world and in some non-Western cultures as well, arguably since time immemorial. The earliest reference that I have come across is in Homer's Odyssey. I was working on the book, using legal depositions primarily, a wonderful source of literary evidence for historians in London. And I started coming across references to a first sleep and somewhat less frequently a second sleep or a morning sleep. Equally bewildering to me was that clearly there was something going on in between these segments. So I had a increasingly large number of references, but what helped me make sense of them was in 1995, December, appropriately enough, around midnight, surfing the internet, I read an article in the New York Times describing the research of Dr. Thomas Weir at the National Institute of Mental Health and a team of assistants who subjected some 15-odd young males to a period of several weeks in which there was no artificial illumination at night. And as Dr. Wu was saying, artificial illumination is profoundly important in its impact upon the sleep-wake cycle, among other circadian rhythms within the body.
I just want to stop for a second and kind of remind people what we're saying when we're saying these segmented sleep. So we say there was about, you would sleep for about 4 hours, you would wake up and have a couple of hours of waking time, and then you'd go back to sleep. And this was really common before the Industrial Revolution, as you said, for a couple of reasons, like the lack of light everywhere, before the invention of the light bulb, before we had street lights, as well as kind of the shift in human culture to this 9-to-5 workday, or not even 9-to-5, but much more industrious workday, and a huge priority placed on productivity. So we stopped encouraging this two shift of sleep. And I wonder, I mean, what did we used to do during those 2 hours in the middle of the night that we began to lose when we moved
anything
away?
Anything and everything imaginable.
Like what?
People prayed. There were special prayers to be said in, after your first sleep. They meditated. They reflected. Many reflected upon dreams from whence they had just awakened. Others, of course, used chamber pots, but then still others left their beds. They performed chores. There's a wonderful passage in Virgil's Aeneid describing this. Performed chores that required very little light and virtually no skill in the dead of night. Some left their homes, visited neighbors, or I think even more commonly, pilfered apples from a neighbor's orchard. It was a prime time for petty crime. It was also, in the view of physicians writing in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, a prime opportunity in which to conceive children after the first sleep, when a couple would be more rested. In the words of Laurent Joubert, a French physician in the 16th century, it is after the first sleep when couples, and I'm quoting him verbatim, do it better and enjoy it more.
There you go. One of the consequences to losing those two shifts of sleep in the night. Well, I want to bring in one more guest to our conversation now, Mary Ellen Wells. She's the director of the Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Science Program at the UNC School of Medicine. Mary Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
So we've just been talking about this previous way that humans used to sleep. Tell us about the science behind the 7 to 8 hours that we've been talking about. Is there science supporting that that's actually ideal for humans, for adult humans?
Well, sleep needs, they vary for every individual. But what we do know is that different age groups typically need a certain amount of sleep. So children, infants are going to require a great deal of sleep, and then children and adolescents require still more sleep than adults would, and then adults, a typical adult, maybe 7 to 9 hours. And then as you go into older adulthood, we really require still the same amount, but perhaps a little tiny bit less.
And as we said earlier with Jade, it can differ person to person a little bit, and your genetics kind of can shape how much sleep you might need. But there are a lot of people who come to you and come to your sleep lab because they are really struggling with getting a full night's sleep or feeling rested. So explain to us what a sleep lab does and what you do there.
Absolutely. So in a sleep lab, it's essentially people coming in and sleeping overnight in the lab, and it's a study called a polysomnography. And when you come into the lab, our lab is based in a hospital, and some labs are freestanding, some are in hospitals. And when you come into our lab, it's like coming into a little bit different world. It doesn't look quite like a hospital. So when you come in, you are coming in around 7 p.m. typically, and you are assigned a technologist that's going to work with you throughout the night. And then you're escorted to a private room. And the private room has your own personal bathroom, television, all the amenities of home is what we're striving for in our sleep lab rooms. And then we are going to hook up sensors and wires on your head to monitor brain waves, on your eyes to monitor eye movements, on your chin and legs to monitor your muscle movements. We put belts around you to monitor your respirations. We're going to monitor your heart. And so there's a lot of things that are going to be hooked up that you're going to be sleeping throughout the night with all of that. And then we basically monitor you through the night to look for different sleep disorders. The main one that is very common is sleep disordered breathing, which is called sleep apnea. And that's when you essentially stop breathing multiple times during the night.
Are there other common ones? I would say one that many people think of is maybe sleepwalking. Can you talk about what is actually happening during the brain and sleepwalking and how common it is that you see something like that in the lab?
So sleepwalking, it can be surprisingly common. About 1 to 15% of the population can suffer from sleepwalking at any point. And it's more common in children. And it's one of what we call a parasomnia. And what those are is essentially acting out or movements, odd things that are happening during the night. And there are a couple of different types. And we had talked about REM sleep and non-REM sleep as two completely different states, like with wake. So you essentially have three completely different states of being, sleep or awake and non-REM sleep and then REM sleep. And there are certain parasomnias that happen during REM sleep and certain parasomnias that happen during non-REM sleep. Sleepwalking is one of those that happens during non-REM sleep, REM sleep is essentially your dreaming state. And sleepwalking, you know, it's not entirely understood exactly why this happens to people, but there are many things that can spark it to happen, such as sleep deprivation is one that can commonly cause that to happen. Another common issue is medications can cause this to happen. Alcohol can cause this to happen. And numerous other things could potentially cause this to happen. And sleepwalking is very, very dangerous. The person doesn't, you know, they're not aware that this is happening. So there's a misperception out there that you should never wake a sleepwalker. And, you know, in fact, it can be quite dangerous if, you know, the person could get themselves into quite a pickle.
I want to play a clip from a listener now who has a question and a story about things that happened to her overnight. Let's listen.
I do a lot of weird things in my sleep. I talk a lot. My siblings talk a lot. So if we're on vacation and sleeping in the same room, we'll talk back and forth to each other. I often wake up screaming and jumping out of my bed because I think bugs are coming out of the ceiling or the ceiling fan. But my strangest sleep story was one time when I woke up and I was standing straight up in my bed, ripping through the mosquito netting that was hanging from the cross beams of my four-poster bed.
So that's listener Allie Meyer with her sleep story. I'm here with sleep experts Jade Wu and Mary Ellen Wells. I'm not going to ask you to diagnose her per se, but could you maybe explain what causes all of these physical things that we're doing in our sleep? So a lot of people may talk. They may not sleepwalk, but they may talk. They may clench their jaw. They may have kind of restless leg syndrome and be moving their bodies around a lot. What leads to these various physical activity during sleep?
Well, with many sleep disorders, it's still much of a mystery of how this works, and there are just so many things that play into it. And sleep, it crosses every single discipline. It affects every body system. It's connected in many ways to diseases that we didn't even realize were connected until, you know, much more recently, diabetes and heart disease. So sleep crosses everything. And that's part of the problem is sleep essentially is a function of the brain. And, you know, there's still so many mysteries yet that we have to discover.
So there's a lot that's unknown, but Jade, I want to talk with you about insomnia. You mentioned it earlier in the show, and that's one of the main things you work on. And it's striking to me that the most effective kind of cure for insomnia is actually like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about that.
Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI for short, is a, I liken it to PT, like physical therapy. It's a very short-term brief treatment that where you work with a therapist to identify what are the factors that are keeping you awake, that are keeping you in this rut of insomnia. And then we're taking those factors out of the way by teaching you skills, by giving you strategies to try. We send you home with some monitoring and some homework, and you come back after having tried those, and then we tweak. So the good thing about CBTI is that it identifies and addresses the actual root problems that keep insomnia going. I think most of us probably experience short-term insomnia at some point in our life, and usually insomnia resolves itself after a couple of weeks, couple of months. But when insomnia becomes a long-term chronic problem, then it's almost universal what the factors are that are keeping it going. So we have a lot of good research on that, and we've condensed that research into this treatment that works for a lot of people.
What are those factors?
Yeah, so for example, if you think of the things that we intuitively reach for when our sleep is not good, like making up for sleep that we think we didn't get on weekends, sleeping in, canceling evening appointments or evening activities so we can protect our sleep, things like staying in sleep in bed for a really long time, trying really hard to sleep. It's very understandable why people might try these strategies, right? But unfortunately, they have this unintended backfiring effect, where the longer we stay in bed not sleeping, the more we're teaching our brains and our bodies that sleep is a struggle. The bed is a battleground. It's not a good place to be. And it's a place where you should be alert and frustrated and angsty. And that ends up perpetuating the insomnia problem for longer.
It's Embodied today. We're talking about the science of sleep on The State of Things. So you describe this kind of relationship with your bed and the bedroom and healing that. And one of the things that people recommend is actually getting, like, if you are not falling asleep, instead of lying in your bed and telling yourself, like, you know, it's better to just be in my bed than it is to be on my iPad out in the living room. Maybe that's not actually the case. Maybe it's better to get up and get out of your bed and change your environment so that your bed is associated with restful sleep. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's really important to know that this recommendation is not meant as a tool to get you back to sleep immediately. You may get up out of bed and be up for the rest of the night. That could happen. And that's okay. What we're trying to do here is prevent you, your body and brain, from learning that the bed is a bad place. And also, don't worry about a little bit of TV light or iPad light. I know earlier I said that light was really important, but you would really need to have a bright light iPad in front of your face for hours for that to really have an effect. So I would rather you just get out of bed, relax, think about something else, do something else interesting, instead of spending your time trying really hard to sleep. Because the number one thing to avoid is actually trying to sleep if you have insomnia. Insomnia is one of the very few things in life that does not reward hard work. And I like to think of sleep as sort of your shy but reliable friend, that friend that will come back and hang out with you. She really likes you, I promise. She will come back. But if you are really intense in the relationship, you're stalking her, you're trying to hunt her down, then she's going to go further underground and run away from you. So just sit back and open your arms in this sort of inviting and relaxed attitude. Allow sleep to come to you when sleep is ready, and listen to your body. And that's the only way you'll know how much sleep you really need.
Do techniques like counting sheep work?
I think counting sheep is the right idea, but it's probably not engaging enough because okay. It gets real boring real fast, right? There's actually a great study where someone with insomnia who is doing math, like adding 13s, you know, versus someone who doesn't have insomnia adding 13s. The person who has insomnia doing that actually ends up falling asleep faster, because a person without insomnia is staying awake because they're trying to do math. But the person with insomnia is actually distracting themselves from their own angsty thoughts about sleep. And we also know from science that people with insomnia actually have, their brain is actually more active in response to insomnia-related cues like sound of heartbeat, sound of clock ticking. So it's not... It is technically all in your head, in the sense that it is literally in your brain. Your brain is reacting differently to these cues than people who don't have sleep problems. So it's a very real issue, but you can help yourself by distracting yourself by engaging your brain in something else.
We'll continue our conversation about sleep today on The State of Things just ahead. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking about sleep today on Embodied. It's our recurring series about sex, relationships, and your health. We dove into how sleep works and what it takes to get the sleep you need. And soon, we're going to talk about an element that continues to hold our curiosity, which is dreaming. With me still is Roger Ekirch, a university distinguished professor in the Department of History at Virginia Tech. Also with me is Mary Ellen Wells, the director of the Neurodiagnostics and Sleep Science Program at the UNC School of Medicine, and Jade Wu, a health psychologist at Duke University who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. So we were talking about insomnia. We were talking about sleep disorders. So I want to ask you both about sleeping pills. So what is happening in our brain when we take a sleeping pill? Is it giving us the same kind of sleep as we would get naturally without one?
Well, I don't think that's the case. So I'm not a medical doctor, so take what I say with a grain of salt. But there are lots of different types of sleeping pills that people take, whether it's over the counter, whether it's prescribed, and even prescribed medications can have different types of actions on your sleep. And the problem with sleep medications is that it does not really give you the type of sleep that you would want. So some medications actually keep you in lighter stages of sleep and doesn't allow you to go into deeper stages as much. And in any case, I think the real problem with sleeping pills in the long run is that people tend to develop tolerance to them. So there's a very good reason why they exist. For short-term insomnia, they can be super helpful. I'm not, slamming sleeping pills overall. But in the long run, I think sleeping pills do not get to the root of the issue, does not actually change the mechanisms that maintain insomnia, and therefore doesn't really give you the type of sleep that you would want.
So they may zonk you out, but you're not necessarily going to be going through those stages of sleep that you need to clear your lymphatic system, to maybe consolidate memories, to go through all of those stages.
Correct. Although I wouldn't say a sleep medication completely disrupts sleep architecture, but for example, people often self-medicate with alcohol. And alcohol is something that actually makes your sleep more fragmented and gives you less of an opportunity to get consolidated, good, deep sleep.
It's such a bummer. So the idea of a nightcap is really just a big myth, huh?
I assume different people had different tolerances for alcohol. I wouldn't be able to speak to that for each individual right now. But yeah, overall, alcohol is not really a good solution to insomnia.
How about, Mary Ellen, how about things like melatonin? What do those do, and what's their function for sleep hygiene?
So melatonin is a hormone, and it's created in the brain. And melatonin itself, it doesn't make you go to sleep. But what it does do is it gives your body the signal that it's time to go to sleep. And melatonin is, like we were talking earlier about circadian rhythms, and our largest driver of our circadian rhythm is the solar light. So sunlight is what drives our 24-hour rhythm, our sleep and wake. And so melatonin is released in the brain when we're not getting light. And so at night, when melatonin starts to be released, that starts to give your body the signals that it is time to go to bed. And so, here recently, they've been marketing a lot of melatonin in the in the stores. However, melatonin, since it's a hormone, it's a supplement.
And so it's not regulated.
It is not regulated. So when you take melatonin, you don't know what you're actually getting in the melatonin pills. Some drugs or some of the pills may not have any melatonin in them.
And some may have. I've read studies up to almost like 800% of the amount that they say on the bottle. So
exactly.
Huge variability there. I want to talk briefly about dreams before we bring in another guest. And Roger E. Kirch, you're still with us, a university distinguished professor in the Department of History at Virginia Tech. Tell me about what you learned about how our ancestors approached the idea of dreaming.
They took dreams extraordinarily seriously. They could have an impact on one's life for several minutes, several years. Thomas Tryon, a 17th century English philosopher, correctly summed up the perception of dreams when he wrote that night teaches us what we are, day teaches us what we should be.
Hmm.
Could I just add a friendly amendment to the prior remarks relating to insomnia?
Sure.
And that is that the historical case is very strong. And I'm not a scientist. I got a B in high school chemistry. But this interpretation has been widely accepted by large portions of the sleep medical community. Simply put, waking up in the middle of the night was not regarded as abnormal until the late 19th, early 18th century, when it became tarred with sleep onset insomnia as middle-of-the-night insomnia, which is today the most prevalent sleep disorder in the United States. Put differently, what has traditionally, for the last 100 years, been viewed as a abnormality, which has frustrated large numbers of people who describe themselves as freaks, because they wake up in the middle of the night, in many cases, I can't say with much precision, but any number of sleep psychiatrists have told me that in many cases, when informed that their pattern of sleep was natural before the Industrial Revolution, they find that immensely reassuring. They're less anxious, and they're more apt to fall back asleep than otherwise would have been possible. Simply put, from an historical perspective, their sleep in many cases is not abnormal. It's natural.
There you go. History giving us a way to sleep better at night. Thanks so much to all of you. My guest, Roger E. Kirch, a university distinguished professor in the Department of History at Virginia Tech, Mary Ellen Wells, the director of neurodiagnostics and sleep science at the UNC School of Medicine, and Jade Wu, a health psychologist at Duke University specializing in behavioral sleep medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sweet dreams.
I want to move now to one more guest who's going to share a different kind of unconscious state with us, hibernation. Sheena Faherty is a science communicator. She conducted doctoral research into hibernation in lemurs at the Duke Lemur Center. Sheena, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about hibernation. What is it and how is it different from all of the kinds of sleep that we've been talking about so far in the show?
Yeah, so hibernation is actually not what most people think that it is. The connection to sleep is that there really isn't a connection to sleep, because when an animal is in hibernation, they're not actually sleeping as far as we can tell. So I'm going to switch the terminology a little bit, just because hibernation is sort of a misnomer. So the actual physiological state of what we think of as hibernation is called torpor, and that is a depressed state of metabolism and body temperature. Heart rate is lowered to, you know, just a few beats a minute, and brain activity during this state of torpor is super, super low voltage, and so it basically looks like the animals are dead. And then these periods of torpor, which last anywhere between 2 days and 2 weeks, are punctuated by these periods of rewarming to normal body temperatures, and that's called an interbout arousal. And interestingly, the link between sleep and hibernation is that there is a theory that these animals actually have to resume their body temperatures in order to sleep. Because, as I said, when they're in this torpor state, they're not actually sleeping. And so the theory is that the animals are getting sleep deprived, and so they have to periodically rewarm in order to restore their sleep balances.
Oh, that's so interesting. So yeah. You study lemurs who share some 96% of the genetic code as humans. So what can we learn about the potential for human torpor from studying lemurs? And why do we even care about human torpor?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's the question that keeps me up at night, of course, not sleeping. by better understanding the genetic mechanisms behind, an animal like a lemur that's able to enter this state of torpor, we can better understand if human hibernation or human torpor could be a thing. So I know a lot of people are really interested in this question. NASA is really interested in it because of, things like space travel. And these types of things have applications to, emergency medicine and organ transplantation. So it's really an exciting possibility to think that, because lemurs share so much of their DNA with a human, and they can hibernate. So could humans potentially hibernate? And that was the question that I was looking at during my doctoral research.
What did you find out?
So it turns out that we believe that humans actually have the genetic capability to be able to enter a state of torpor. So we know this because what we found in the lemur, so we were looking at, I specifically was looking at sort of how the metabolism is regulated throughout the hibernation season. So like I said, when these animals are in torpor, their body temperatures are, basically tracking ambient temperature, which can be as low as, 0 degrees, basically near freezing. But along with that, their metabolism also is profoundly depressed. And so we were looking at white adipose tissue, so their fat tissue that they store massive amounts of fat tissue before they go into hibernation. And then they, once they enter into torpor, they burn through those fat stores. And so we wanted to know what was happening to the metabolism throughout the hibernation season. And what we find is that the same metabolic pathways and genes that are involved in these metabolic pathways that are regulating these changes in metabolism that happen throughout the year and throughout the hibernation season are the same genetic pathways and genes that humans have already. And so in theory, humans have the capability to, enter a torpor-like state based on this finding.
So these fat-tailed lemurs that store all of their fat in their tail or a lot of it during their torpor state, their metabolism changes in a way that they're able to metabolize fat for energy instead of carbohydrates, which allows them to kind of stay functioning during the state of torpor.
Correct, because during torpor, they're not eating at all. They, in fact, they don't eat the whole hibernation season. So these animals are going from about 6 to 8 months without eating anything, because even during these periodic arousals where they rewarm their body temperatures, they don't actually wake up and move around. They just kind of stay in their burrow and, we think they're sleeping. And so they have to have these energy sources to get them through 6 to 8 months of no food or water for that matter.
I'm talking with Sheena Faherty. We're talking about sleep science today on The State of Things. So there is a type of human hibernation that happens in hospitals called therapeutic hypothermia. Can you tell me what this is and what we can learn from it about the potential for being able to send humans to Mars, for example?
Yeah, so I'm not a medical doctor, but my understanding is that, you know, if something horrible happens to a human, say they have a traumatic brain injury and the brain is swelling, medical doctors will use this technique to induce a coma-like state or a suspended animation state in these patients by using some sort of barbiturate or in combination with cooling the body temperature down. And that sort of just, preserves everything. It keeps the brain from expending a lot of excess energy through movement and conscious thought and, things like that. That being said, it's not the same as what an animal experiences when they're in this state of torpor, because basically all, from what I understand, all voluntary or involuntary bodily actions like respiration and heart rate have to be sort of, I think they have to be regulated when humans are in this state of, medically induced coma. Whereas in torpor, these bodily functions are still happening. They're just at a very, very slowed down pace. And also, I believe that body temperature only gets as, a few degrees lower than normal body temperature, say 93 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas in torpor, the body temperature will be, like I said, close to zero. And in some animals, their body temperature can get below 0 degrees, which is really amazing.
So in all of your research and studying lemurs, what has struck you most about what lemurs could potentially teach us about our own sleep patterns as humans, or our own kind of capacity for change in how we think about sleep and consciousness in humans?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about the sleep aspect, but I know that, the link between sleep and metabolism is very important. And so by looking at these studies, the studies that I was doing looking at metabolism, these have very, very practical applications for things like obesity research and type 2 diabetes research and, metabolic disorders. Because if we can figure out how these animals are regulating their metabolism in such a way that's, to any other animal that is a non-hibernator, the way that they regulate their metabolism would be pretty harmful, but these animals can do it without ill effect. So everyone wants to talk about the whole, can we put humans into hibernation and send them into space? And that's the big picture question. And you ask any hibernation researcher if that's the end goal, and they will all, jump and say, yes, that's the end goal. But I think there are a lot more applications that are more realistic that we could be focusing on now, like, the obesity epidemic and things like that.
And some applications that may be slightly less ethically problematic. Sheena Faherty is a science communicator. She conducted doctoral research into hibernation in lemurs at the Duke Lemur Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You can find out more about everyone we talked about today, our show, and the entire Embodied series at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is the technical director. Josie Taurus is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.